On this week's 51%, is the country heading for a recession? Either way, we'll learn how to prepare and get through one with Cornell's Suzanne Hsu.
Preparing ahead is things like making sure you have enough in savings to be able to tide you over for a month or two, being able to purchase ahead for things that prices could go up on.
We also chat with journalist Allison Kosick about her new book, What's Up with Women and Money. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Alita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. There's a lot of concern right now over whether we might be heading into a global recession. President Trump has escalated a trade war with other countries and announced a slew of tariffs, some of which he paused shortly before this taping. But regardless, the stock market has tumbled this month, making a lot of people worried about the state of their finances and their 401ks. In recent weeks, Goldman Sachs has raised its prediction of a recession to 45%, while J.P. Morgan has estimated the risk of a recession to be 60%. Again, that's the time of this taping. Being on top of your finances is especially important for women, recession or not. I have been planning to dedicate today's episode to financial literacy anyway, but given the uncertainty and volatility right now, I thought it would be good to have a conversation more fine-tuned to this moment. So with us to chat about recession prep and recession survival is Suzanne Hsu, a professor of marketing and dean of faculty and research at Cornell's S.C. Johnson College of Business. Hsu specifically studies behavioral economics and decision-making and has spent a lot of time looking at how people react to and navigate these times. My hope is that, you know, by talking about it, we can at least feel a little more in control over how we protect ourselves going forward.
A recession is based on a decline in GDP, so the output of the country, along with employment and other indicators that they look at it. And the way I tend to think about recessions is that you start to get into this weird spiral where people slow down their purchasing because of maybe uncertainty in the markets or whatever's going on geopolitically or economically. So people start slowing down their purchasing. So as they're buying less, companies start making less and selling less. As companies are cutting back on what they're producing, they need less employees, so they might start laying people off. As people start getting laid off, they purchase less because they have less money to purchase with. And so that spiral just sort of continues. It's an interplay between employment and purchasing and corporate production. And all of those pieces start feeding on each other and being in this downward trend. It's hard to say that there's any one indicator we look at to try to predict when a recession's coming. It's the combination of the three. But certainly, as you start hearing people around you say, oh, I'm not going to spend as much because I'm a little uncertain about what's coming next, and I'm just afraid of what's happening in the economy, so I'm cutting back on my travel, and I'm cutting back on buying new appliances or new cars or having work done on the house or whatever, that starts to be a sign that there's a lot of consumer uncertainty, and that could start leading to this downturn in all of these other indicators down the road.
How should you prepare for a recession, or do you have some, I guess, recession do's and don'ts for us?
It's tricky to know how to prepare best, and I think everyone's situation is going to be different because a lot of the question you have to ask is, how secure do I feel in terms of my employment? Is my employer going to cut back on my hours? Is there some risk that I'm going to lose my job? And I think some people are kind of aware. I mean, I've talked to people who work in industries that are being affected by some of the political and economic things that are happening right now, and they're aware that their job might be at risk. Whereas other people, I think, feel pretty comfortable that their job is going to continue no matter what happens on some of those larger issues. So that's certainly a piece of it. If you're someone who is concerned that your hours could be cut or some of these pressures are coming, then I think preparing ahead is things like making sure you have enough in savings to be able to tide you over for a month or two if your hours are cut or, worst case, you're out of work. Being able to purchase ahead for things that prices could go up on. And a lot of the economic conversation lately has been about tariffs and what that will do to prices. And so things where you're purchasing something that might be imported from another country, where there's some risk that the prices could go up, smartphones and computers and cars and so forth, trying to purchase ahead on some of those things might make sense so that you're not stuck purchasing when prices are actually higher. It's a time where you don't want to get yourself committed to a reoccurring cost that could be hard to live up to if you're, you know, if your situation changes. So, for example, committing to travel in the next 6 months or a year is certainly one, but other kinds of reoccurring costs, like taking on, you know, a new car payment or taking on a new subscription service that you're going to be committed to for some period of time. You know, things that you want to have, things that you can change if you need to, if your financial situation changes. So, you know, having subscriptions like Netflix or streaming or other things that you can cancel if you need to cancel them quickly, and not being pre-committed and being stuck with them that you can't walk away if your situation changes. Savings is probably the big one, though, that you want to have enough savings to carry you through if employment shifts.
And that savings amount you mentioned, I just want to make sure that I heard that right. So that's 2 to 3 months?
2 to 3 months is the typical recommendation for having good savings, that if you do hit a period of unemployment, then you know that sort of rent and groceries and utilities and the basics are going to be covered while you're looking for a new job. It starts to get scary, of course, if someone is unemployed for longer than 2 or 3 months, but that's kind of the general rule of thumb that I often hear.
I mean, if you are lucky enough to have a surplus where you could potentially invest in the market, what should you do when markets are down? You know, in recession time, what is considered risky versus non-risky?
Honestly, the most important thing to remember, whether it's a recession or not a recession, but certainly during a recession, is the age that you're at and the time frame you have ahead of you to think about your savings and investment. So imagine someone, say, maybe in their early to mid-20s, who's starting out in a working environment and still has 25 or 30 years before they need to think about retirement, right? As long as their employment is going to be relatively stable and they're not worried about becoming unemployed in the next few months, I would encourage increasing the investment, because you have a long time period. And all of the research shows that anyone who can invest over a 10 or 20 year time period, things like stock market investments, which are considered typically risky, go up over the long run. And so if you can put money into something like the stock market and leave it there for 20 years, it can be stressful to watch it go up and down during a recession or even a depression or other volatility in the market. But over a 20-year period, you come out ahead. And that's worth thinking about. So somebody who's younger, I would say investing is a great thing to be able to do if you're not worried about the employment piece. For someone who's older, though, and getting closer to retirement, you know, if you're in your 50s or 60s and you have a 5 or 10 year horizon before you're thinking of retiring, then that risk starts to get a little dangerous, because you could see the value of your investment drop pretty significantly in that shorter time frame. And if you're planning on retiring and needing that money within the short period, there's a chance that it'll go down and it won't be there for you when you need it. And so there, I think the shift from risky investments to safer investments makes a lot more sense. And the general advice that we give on investing in something like the stock market is, if your time horizon is a long one, then go for the risky side, because the returns will be better. If your time horizon is a shorter one, then you want to be shifting to the safer things. And what exactly that mix is a little bit up to each person and how much risk they're willing to take and whether they feel like they have, you know, enough to be stable. But I think that's sort of the just general rule of thumb that people should be thinking about. If you're young and you have a long time period, then put it in the risky investments and just don't peek at it. Like, let it sit there. Don't check it. If you check it every day, you're going to stress yourself out, and that's not worth it.
Something that's been on my mind, and I know that your focus is primarily on like behavioral economics, so this might just be sort of me thinking out loud. But, you know, I learned in school that, you know, the economy goes through these cycles. So we go up and we go down, and you just kind of got to roll with the punches, and eventually things come back up. But, you know, as we talk about tariffs, we talk about this market instability and stuff. In this case, it feels kind of man-made. Does that impact how we should be looking at this or how we should be acting in this particular recession compared to previous recessions? I guess my main question for you really would be sort of like, what are you keeping an eye out for as you're watching how people behave in this particular situation if we do in fact get to the point of a recession?
What I've studied in economics, the thing that is interesting to me is that we sort of assume that economists have this perfect model for how the system works. And I don't think the model is always as perfect as we hope it is. It changes all the time and what the inputs and what the influences are going to be. And so we can try to learn from history, and we have learned from history things about how tariffs influence an economy or what happens if you push this button or that button or, you know, make certainly changes to how the system works. But we don't know perfectly what's going to happen. And everybody has sort of different opinions. There's this old joke about, I forget which president made it, but, you know, you have an economist who comes in the room and says, well, on the one hand, this could happen. On the other hand, this could happen. And we don't perfectly know exactly what's going to happen with every change that humans make as part of the system. So you're right. Some of it is man-made, but some of it's happening because the decisions we're making, we don't have a perfect recipe for what the influence or what the outcomes are going to be. The best we can do is, you're right, ride out those cycles. Recessions are a part of the normal up and down, and we're going to run into them every once in a while. We ran into it in 2020 with COVID a little bit. We ran into it in 2008 with the housing crisis. We've run into it, you know, multiple times. I've been around long enough that I have lots of memories of going through those ups and downs. And it is part of the normal cycles that we have to live through. And the good news is that we tend to come out of them on the other side and learn from each one of them as we go, and try to do a little bit better the next time around.
Well, I don't want to like bring the whole conversation further downward, I guess, but what's the difference between a recession and a depression? And what are the signs that a depression is imminent?
We've been, at least in my lifetime, we've been pretty lucky that most of the recessions we've sort of fallen into, when they've been defined as a recession, we tend to pull out of quickly enough that it's not a depression again. It's hard to predict when we get far enough into a recession that it's going to start turning into a depression. I'm not sure what the indicators would be other than we're just not moving out of it fast enough. And this is one where I think we have learned from history that when a recession starts to happen, how can we start to sometimes put money back into the economy, right? Do government investments. I mean, this is something that I think they learned during the Great Depression. You know, if you go back 100 years, that putting money into sort of infrastructure and government spending and things like that helped pull the U.S. out of the Great Depression. And I think even some of the recessions that we've had over the last few decades, you've seen governments try to step in and help and try to offer benefits. Even during COVID, right, they were sending money out to households to try to boost spending and help households feel a little bit more comfortable. So there are things that the government and policymakers can do to try to keep us from extending a recession into a depression.
Have you noticed a difference in the way men and women approach their finances or, you know, approach navigating through a recession?
So that's an interesting question. And I do think that as more women come into leadership around the world, we will learn about perhaps different approaches to these situations as they come up. And both from a leadership perspective, right, how do men and women leaders approach these kinds of decisions, but then how to live through them. I do think your question is absolutely right, that men and women who are living through recessions or depressions have different reactions to how to survive them. If you have a grandmother who lived through the Depression and she would, you know, re-rinse the aluminum foil and the Ziploc bags and store them and, you know, can things and save them in the basement and whatever. Historically, when household tasks would be divided, you know, the men might have been worried about paying the bills and the women might have been worried about how do we make the household function in this more constrained environment. I think today, where those tasks are shared more equally between the sexes, right, it's useful for women to be thinking about, okay, how do we change the investment profile? How do we make sure that we can have enough money and have enough savings to get through this? Sit down once in a while and learn what's going on and make sure that you're up to date and up to speed on how the finances are working in a household. If you don't feel comfortable enough doing it yourself, at least you want to be informed on how it's being done so that if it ever becomes a situation where you have to take over, you're ready to step in and be the one in charge.
Suzanne Hsu is the John S. Dyson Professor of Marketing at Cornell's SC Johnson College of Business, where her work and research has focused heavily on behavioral economics. You can learn more about her work at business.cornell.edu. In news that shouldn't surprise anyone, the U.S. still has a solid gender pay gap, although it has decreased over the past 20 years or so. In 2023, women earned an average of 81 cents on the dollar compared to men, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. In New York, women fared slightly better. According to a new report by State Controller Tom DiNapoli, New York women earned 87 cents on the dollar compared to men in 2023. That still means women would have to work an extra 53 days to make what male New Yorkers made. Overall, DiNapoli says the median annual pay for a woman working full-time in New York was $62,111. Women's median earnings as a share of men's earnings declined in the state from 2021 and remained lower than in 2015. Like I said earlier, I had been planning to talk about finances today anyway, because I think it's something that a lot of women, myself included, feel anxiety over. I've never felt like a woman who's very good at money, and our next guest says that's not uncommon in the slightest. Women are not generally socialized to focus on money the same way men are as they grow up. We're not pushed to take the reins of our finances the same way men are. Allison Kosick wrote a book about this, offering tips for how women can feel more confident in this aspect of their lives. Kosick is a former business correspondent for CNN and a freelance anchor at ABC News. Her book called What's Up with Women and Money serves as both a how-to guide and a memoir.
I'm going to tell you something embarrassing. I was CNN's business correspondent, and I would report often from the New York Stock Exchange. And I, in my own life, wasn't involved with my finances at all. I wasn't involved in my financial life. I let my husband do all things financial because I thought that he was better at it. And I also thought that I didn't have enough time to really learn about it. And letting him sort of take the lead in all that was one of the biggest mistakes of my life, because when the marriage went bad and because I relied on him for all things financial, I felt stuck. I stayed in the marriage years longer than I should have. I had two kids under the age of 10 at the time, and I was afraid. What if I lost all of our money? I mean, what if I made a mistake? And so that kept me in the marriage longer than I should have been. And when I got through it, I discovered there were a lot of women across the economic spectrum who feel the way I felt. I'm talking low earners to high earners, married women, divorced, single, widowed, all felt the same way, but these women don't want to admit it because they don't want to seem like they're unintelligent. But it's not that I've learned later, it's not that we're incompetent or incapable. It's just that we're not confident. I mean, when I was married, I wasn't confident that I can make those financial decisions. I didn't think I had the good judgment or knowledge of the experience of making those financial decisions because I wasn't actively involved. And so I wrote the book because I want to make sure other women don't make the same mistakes that I make. And I want to help them have a place to go where women aren't going to feel overwhelmed of where to start and how to start with all the financial things. And I also want to try to change the conversation that oftentimes women have about money, because the conversation oftentimes for many women is one that is shrouded in, in mystery and misunderstanding and fear.
Why is that? So I guess, to ask the title of your book, What's Up with Women and Money?
So, I mean, it could be as simple as part of it was with me. I was so busy with my life that, raising the kids, I told my husband, you do it. You're good at it. I trust you, which is a no-no. Even if you trust the person, and I'll tell you why. There's the being busy. There's also the cultural aspect to it that women are socialized to believe that money is intimidating and it's complicated and it's complex and I can't handle it. And that's just not the case. Especially when you see what happens from those cultural and societal expectations is you sort of lose your confidence in doing that thing because you're made to believe that you can't. And that can lead to the issue. Also, part of it is we watched our parents, and whether we want to believe it or not, we're conditioned to handle money oftentimes like they do or they did. The advice that I give is first figure out what's going wrong in your money life, as far as whether it's your spending or you're not investing enough consistently. Find out where you got those money beliefs. And then change them. And there's a step-by-step process you can go through, refer to the book, but there is a way to change it and then become responsible for yourself and how you're handling your money.
So what was the first step for you in changing your money habits?
Well, I was sort of forced into it because of the divorce. And I thought I was on my financial game when I told my husband I want a divorce. And then I was like, uh-oh, I didn't plan for this at all. And so I did it by making mistakes. One of the first things I had to do was turn in my leased car. And I thought, how hard can this be? I'm a smart girl. I can just go in there. I'm just going to wing it. No, you're not supposed to wing it. I walked in and the car salesman asked me, are you looking to lease or buy? And I told him. And then he said, what monthly payment do you want? And I told him. And little did I know, just by answering those two questions, I lost all leverage. Fast forward, I wound up getting a car from that place. And I probably got ripped off based on what he was charging me. And that's one of my chapters in there is how to buy a car as a woman. And as far as investing goes, I honestly started doing a lot more research. I started talking with a lot more people who I worked with at the New York Stock Exchange. I was lucky to be in that environment and started to sort of teach myself. And just by making those little investments and those little transactions, investing didn't seem as intimidating as I once thought it did. And so I came to the realization that with all this financial stuff that we sort of avoid, and whether that's our estate plan or our life insurance or, budgeting, that all this stuff may seem intimidating, but once you start making those little transactions, they're like little wins that make you start feeling that confidence that you were so lacking maybe before.
I didn't know that about car dealerships, and I've now bought a lease twice now. So I guess why shouldn't you answer those two questions when buying a car?
Think of it this way. If you the car salesman does that, or the car saleswoman does that every day. That's her job. That's his job. You do it once in, every couple of years, every 3 years. You're not adept at all the ins and outs. I know I'm not. And so I learned through interviews that by giving away those two pieces of information, a car salesman, the finance folks in the back, can they input it into some sort of calculator and they create a way to make a big profit because they know what's in your head. But one of the biggest pieces of advice I got is don't give away a lot of information. Be very general and don't be obvious about what you want, from everything from the color to the monthly payment.
This will make me sound silly, probably, but like, how do you get the car you want without telling them what you want during the negotiation?
You put that off till the end. How much do you want to spend? Oh, we can talk about that later. Right now, I'm trying to look for this car that, by the way, you found online in the menu. You can go into the manufacturer and see what cars are on the lot. Make sure they have your car. And then you're not even at the dealership doing this. You're sending emails and you're making phone calls from home. You're making the deal happen before you even walk into the showroom. It's great because that means that you always have the control.
But I'd like to talk a little about budgeting now, because I imagine that, to do all of this, you have to nail down your budget first.
Absolutely. That is the first step, budgeting, seeing how much money that you have after you pay your bills and pay your monthly, all the expenses that you have to pay, and then all the money you have coming in. I go through a whole budget as well in the book. But yes, budgeting is super important. And budgeting is great because what you can wind up doing with budgeting is really delineating what parts of your budget and how much will, and you were giving investing as an example, how much you should invest every month. And I suggest investing consistently and invest as early as you can, but you should only invest if you're not carrying credit card debt, because that is some of the costliest debt you can carry. And the suggestion I have is pay off that debt first, because you're not going to be able to make that kind of percentage back in the market, because right now credit card rates are 20 to 25% for your annual interest rate. So you wouldn't be making that back in the stock market.
When it comes to deciding, you know, whether to save, whether to invest, whether to pay down debt, I mean, a lot of us are trying to do all three. How do you navigate balancing those goals and objectives?
Yeah, you have to first think about what those goals are. You know, maybe your goal includes just being able to survive, and you are having to pay student loans. I mean, deferring your student loan for a few months wouldn't be so awful. I mean, unfortunately for many graduates, that debt is going to be dead on your back for a while. Putting it on hold that it even accrues an interest rate at the end of the day probably doesn't really amount to much. So it may give you a breather, so then you can figure out what your goals are and figure out how much money then you, once you put the loan back in, you know, being able to pay it, how much you can pay it. Maybe you can negotiate a different amount every month that's easier for you. And also at the same time, by doing that, maybe you'll be able to put some money away for investments, especially since student loans are going to be with you for such a long time. If you're not carrying credit card debt and you're ready to start investing, then I would say go for it. That emergency fund, though, that you mentioned, super important, especially if you're one to use credit cards. You don't want that to become a cycle where you have to keep using your credit card for an emergency instead of having an emergency savings account.
If you're new to investing, how do you see women sort of dipping their toes into the markets? Like, do you get an advisor?
A lot of times, if you don't have a lot of money, you can just do it yourself. Certified financial planners and would probably say, oh my gosh, don't give that advice. But you know, if you're a newbie, you can probably start on your own, you know, open up an account, Betterment or Fidelity, open up your retirement account. I would suggest if your income is lower, you're not looking for a tax break early on, you can go ahead and open a Roth instead of a traditional and start with index funds. That way you capture the most diversification as possible in one trade. And you don't have to buy a full share. Now, platforms like Fidelity have fractional share investing. So if you can't afford a share that's $550, you only have 100 for the month, throw the 100 in, you'll still earn a dividend on every little bit, and you're starting, and that time is on your side because you're young. You can't save your way to wealth. You have to invest because of the compounding interest and because of just the compounding effect of money being in the market for so long.
You include your story in the book, but also stories from women from all walks of life who have struggled to take the reins on their finances. Were there any stories that, I guess, surprised you?
There were many surprises, actually. One woman I interviewed, a venture capitalist, that's someone who raises capital for a company, helps them grow, you know, raises money. She was in a very bad situation. She was sobbing to me on the phone. I felt terrible for her. 53 years old, and she characterize money as, I feel overwhelmed. I don't have it in me to, I'm not savvy with money. And she, at 53 years old, didn't even have one retirement account set up. She had never budgeted, and she didn't know the basics of personal finance. And that's a woman who raises money for companies, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. Another woman I talked with, wealthy, she worked very hard as well. She, worked at a consulting agency and often gave Fortune 100 CEOs advice on making like $1 billion purchases. She had no idea her financial house was collapsing. She had let her husband do all the money stuff and only found out recently that they are sitting on a mountain of debt and owe $1 million in back taxes that they didn't pay. And so those are the cautionary tales that are told in the book that I thought were really important to tell, so women can understand that it's not just the now. It's not just, oh, I'm not involved in my budgeting, I'll be okay, I'm living paycheck to paycheck, it's good. It's what happens down the line that you're not thinking of after time goes by, that you're not socking away money, and that's life-changing money. That's an opportunity to make life-changing money just by being invested.
Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, even if you trust your partner, everything's good, you should still at least be clued in on your finances. That's a big point of this episode. Remind us all why.
Life can be blissful, and that's great. And I hope that for the couples who allow the man to make the decisions and in the finances, that's great. But the problem is that life can really change on a dime. You know, what if he suddenly dies or you get a divorce? You know, things are blissful now, but forever isn't guaranteed. So you need to have full visibility over what's going on financially in your house. where are all the documents and paperwork for your assets? You know, how do you know how to pay next month's mortgage? What does his life insurance policy look like? How much debt are you carrying? Do you know the passwords? And then there's the idea that if everything's great, what if he just catastrophically screws everything up because he thinks he's the king of Wall Street? You know, where are the checks and balances in that situation? If you're not involved in what's going on, you can't say, oh, wait a minute, we shouldn't put all our money into Bitcoin. No, you know, so that's the importance of being involved, even if you're in a blissfully happy marriage. Things happen. I hope that women really get more involved in managing their financial lives and realize, especially if you're young and or old, it doesn't matter, older, that it's never too late to start getting it together so you create a stronger financial future for yourself.
Allison Kosick is a former business correspondent for CNN, a freelance anchor at ABC News, and the author of What's Up with Women and Money? How to Do All the Financial Stuff You've Been Avoiding. It's out now through Harriman House. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool, so...